Hi, I'm Bob Walker from the Steiner Ranch campus, and we're participating in the 60-60 experience right now with a small group. And our small group is really finding that the hourly reminders are doing a lot for us. And what we've been trying to do is really stop every hour on the hour and really speak with Christ at the time. And we know that it's not always possible, but it's kind of interesting because as you listen to people in our group, they talk, and it's like they hear the little buzz on their phone or they feel it, and it's like, oh, he's talking to me now. And we always try to stop, and we've been actually trying to take a full minute at that time, which is a very long time when you think about it, but in perspective, it's not. And then the other thing now that we've seen is that in our group, I think that what we're experiencing is a much deeper sharing than we've seen before. There's things that are coming out in group now that have just never come out before, and people are just kind of really opening up because we're feeling that the presence is there, and we're being called to ask everybody to help us with these things. And I think that our prayers are starting to be answered. We're starting to feel really good about it, and it's been an interesting experience for me, I will say that for sure. Because, like they're saying, we're finding what it's like to live in the presence rather than avoid it. I think that we are seeing that people are viewing things on a much different basis when you really live this life hour by hour and minute by minute as you go through the day and realize what it is to actually have Jesus standing next to you all day long rather than just fleeting moments when you decide it's time to sit down and read the Bible or talk and whatever. Now it's kind of a constant presence, and it does make a difference in your whole outlook, really, I think, on a day-to-day.
So for those of you who are joining us new, I just want to say to you, we've been in this thing called the 60-60 experiment, which is what Bob was talking about, where every hour on the hour we have set our phones or various things to cause us to stop and ask the question, God, where are you? What are you doing? What are you saying to me? What do I need to know? What is your deal in the world in which I live, and how do I plug into that? In other words, how do you lead me in this moment? And so we've been doing this for a number of weeks, and we're really beginning to catch some insight from God along the way. We're beginning to learn to practice his presence instead of what most of us have done, practice his absence. By kind of living our day as if he doesn't exist, we're stopping to practice his presence to get used to having him be the leader of our lives. Now, in just 2 days, voters are going to go to the polls or to the voting places, and they're going to vote about who will be the next leader of our nation. And I know a lot of people think that that's probably the most important thing that's going to happen this week, right? And yet I would submit to you that deciding who's going to be the leader of your life, who are you looking to, who are we looking to give us direction each day for how we live, that is a much more significant question than even who's going to be the next president of the United States. And so we've been focusing on the person of Jesus Christ. What is he like? How do we know him? How would we be able to follow him, allow him to be the leader of our life and to do that on a moment-by-moment basis? So we've been going through the Gospel of John and actually looking at the words of Jesus as he describes himself. What does Jesus say about himself? And there are 7 I am statements. I am associated with the Old Testament name Yahweh, which is the name for God, which means to be or I am. Jesus says, I am. In other words, I'm deity. And then he attaches to it a descriptor. And today we come to the 6th descriptor, and it's found in John chapter 14. So if you grab a Bible and turn to John chapter 14, we're going to read one of the most famous descriptions that Jesus says about himself today, and then we're going to kind of unpack this to see what this actually looks like, and what does it mean, and how does it fit, and how does it change the way we live? Okay? In John chapter 14, starting in verse 1, we read these words, "Do not let your heart be troubled. Trust in God, trust also in me." Now, let's pause for a minute and ask the question, why would their hearts be troubled? which is kind of a lightweight translation. You probably had better translate this, don't be freaking out, don't be losing it. Don't let your heart just go crazy with anxiety. Now, why would they be doing this? Well, if you go back and study the whole context leading up to chapter 14, this is the last Passover before Jesus Christ is going to be arrested, betrayed, executed on the cross. This is the last couple hours before that takes place. And Jesus is telling his disciples in the upper room right before the Passover, he's telling them, hey guys, I am leaving. I am going to death. You guys can't follow me. But by the way, don't freak out. Don't get upset. Don't get nervous. I mean, their whole world, everything they'd banked their lives on for the last 3 years, that Jesus Christ was going to establish the kingdom, that they would be part of it, that he was going to do something supernatural and they would be part of it. Jesus is saying, I'm gone, I'm going to die, I'm leaving you guys, and you can't follow me. And by the way, one of you is going to betray me, and one of you is going to deny me before the night's over. In other words, you guys are all going to fall apart right in the middle of all this. And in the midst of that, Jesus says, do not let your heart be troubled. And then he says this, he says, trust in God, trust also in me. In other words, he's calling for an act of faith, of belief. And here's what he says. He says in verse 2, in my Father's house are many rooms. If it were not so, I would have told you. I am going there to prepare a place for you. And if I go and prepare a place for you, I will come back and take you to be with me, that you also may be where I am. You know the way to the place where I'm going. And Thomas said to him, Lord, we don't know where you're going, so how can we know the way? And Jesus answered, I am the way and the truth and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. If you really knew me, you would know my Father as well. From now on, you do know him and have seen him. Now, in this passage, Jesus is telling them they need to trust him, put their faith in him, believe in him, because there's something he's going to do that is not witnessable. It's not capable of being observed with the human eyes or in the human experience. He says, I'm actually leaving this world. I'm going to go to the place where my Father is. I'm going to go to heaven, and I'm going to prepare a place, and then I'm going to come get you, and I'm going to make a way to take you there. Well, there's nothing in the human experience that would ever give you the ability to see or validate or prove that to be true, much less know how to make it work in your mind. So this requires an act of faith. In other words, the ability to see beyond what you can actually see, taste, touch, and feel, right? He's calling for an act of faith. You got to believe in some realities that you actually can't validate through human senses. Now, in the midst of all that, it really raises a question that I want us to ask and answer today, and that is a very personal question, a question for you, about you. Here's the question. Does your faith have eyes? Does your faith have eyes? As you wrestle with that, I want us to go back and look at this kind of fleshed out in a story that we read a little bit earlier in John's gospel. If you'll turn back to chapter 4, John chapter 4, this is a phenomenal account that helps us understand the difference between whether we have a faith that actually needs eyes to see or whether we have a faith that doesn't need eyes to see. So we're talking about the quality of your faith, the quality of your faith. Look in John chapter 4, verse 43. This is early in Jesus' ministry. This is the second big miracle that takes place in Jesus' ministry. And we read these words. It says, after 2 days, he left for Galilee. Now, Jesus himself had pointed out that a prophet has no honor in his own country. When he arrived in Galilee, the Galileans welcomed him. In other words, when he comes back home, the initial response of all the people is very positive. The word welcome there implies they were ecstatic to see him and have him come home. Why? He tells them. They had seen all that he had done in Jerusalem at the Passover feast, for they also had been there. So the Galileans who go to the Passover feast in Jerusalem see Jesus, one of their own from their area, show up. And what does Jesus do there? Jesus walks into the temple and he says, the scripture says that my house will be a house of prayer, but you have made it a den of thieves. And he goes in and he turns over all the tables with all of the money that was the exchange rate money that was being used to rip the people off that were coming there to worship. He upsets all of the sacrifices and just messes with the whole religious system. And the Galileans were ecstatic about that. Here's what they're thinking. We've been treated like second-class citizens forever. Those Jews down there in Jerusalem, they treat us as if we're second-class. They bring us in. They rip us off in worship. It's about time somebody stood up to them, and isn't it great that it's somebody from our area? Like one of our own finally stood up to them. And they're pleased with Jesus. Like they said, this guy's great. Now watch what happens. Once more, he visited Cana in Galilee, where he turned the water into wine, and there was a certain royal official whose son lay sick at Capernaum. When this man heard that Jesus had arrived in Galilee from Judea, he went to him and begged him to come and heal his son, who was close to death. And then Jesus makes this really not politically correct statement. He says, unless you people see miraculous signs and wonders, Jesus told him, you will never believe. Interesting response. My son is about to die. He's very sick. Jesus, will you come with me to Capernaum, about 20 miles away, and heal my son? And Jesus' response, and he says, you people, so there's probably, he's saying it not just to the man, but to the other people who are there too, following him. He says, you people are the kind of people that need to see in order to believe. You need signs and wonders. In fact, the signs and wonders phrase means signs or miracles that produce awe in you, that make you go, wow, I can believe because of that. And Jesus says that their faith is actually based on what they can see, what they can observe. And when they see a miracle, they'll believe. Here's the problem with that. The problem is, if your faith is based on what you can see, what happens when the things that are going on in your life do not look like miracles? They don't appear to be going your way. If faith is based on one example of Jesus doing something wonderful on your behalf over and over and over again, what happens on the day when you go through some kind of a trial? You see, faith is really believing what we cannot see. Faith is really believing what we cannot see. If we only believe because we see something, that would be called a superficial form of faith. And we all know what we mean by superficial, right? When you go to the emergency room with a little blood on you and you walk in and the doctor looks at the scratch on your arm and says, that's a superficial wound, and kind of scoffs and walks out while they come and put a little Neosporin and a Band-Aid on it and send you home with a $250 charge. What's the doctor saying? The doctor's saying, listen, that feels like it's a hurt. It kind of looks like it's a hurt. It's kind of bleeding like it's a hurt. But you know what? You're not really hurt. So man up and go home, okay? You're not really hurt. That's just superficial. The same thing is true of faith. If you get wowed by a miracle or you see something out of the ordinary, you say, oh, now I can believe. It feels like faith. It seems like faith, but it's not really faith. It's just superficial faith. And one of the greatest problems that we have as individuals is we equate our superficial faith with the real deal. And so as long as Jesus is doing the kind of things in my life that make my life wonderful, then I believe in him. But when things go wrong, I stop believing in him, or I think he's let me down, or he's not coming through for me, or he's not doing what he's supposed to be doing. If that begins to happen, then I'm not trusting him when I can't see, when it doesn't look right, when it seems dark. I don't trust him when I can't see. I only trust him when I can see. Now, when Jesus makes this statement to this man, the thing we need to understand is that in his world, in Jesus' world, in God's world, fixing a physical problem is not a big deal. In other words, healing this man's son, even though it's a huge deal to the man and obviously to the son, it's not a hard thing for Jesus to do. I mean, let's face it. If we believe that God was the one who put the laws of physics in motion, who created the rules by which the system of the universe actually works, if God wants to come in and suspend those rules to do something different, which is what we would call supernatural intervention, right? A divine miracle. God certainly could do that. In other words, God didn't lock himself into the prison of his own creation. It's not hard to do a physical miracle. Here's what is hard. It's hard to work in the heart of a person. When God gave us free will and allowed us to decide, the issue of faith and the transformation of the human heart, according to the New Testament writers, is the biggest miracle of all. That God could work in the stubbornness and the unbelief of our hearts to transform us into believing people. Now, that's a big miracle. And so what we see here is that Jesus is not just concerned about the son. Jesus is also concerned about the heart of the man. Look what he says in verse, what happens in verse 49. It says, the royal official said, sir, come down before my child dies. Now, in his choice of words there, the word for child is the most precious, intimate, helpless word that you could use. My little boy, my tiny one, my precious one, my one and only. The man is desperate. And look at what Jesus says. Jesus replied, you may go, your son will live. Is there a condition there? You may go, your son will live. What's the guy going to do? Oh, no, you got to come with me, Jesus. If you don't come, look what he does. The man took Jesus at his word. He believed, and he departed. He took Jesus at his word and departed. While he was still on the way, his servant met him with the news that his boy was living. When he inquired as to the time when his son got better, they said to him, the fever left him yesterday at the seventh hour. Then the father realized that this was the exact time at which Jesus had said to him, your son will live. So he and all his household believed. In other words, when Jesus spoke the words, the son was immediately healed. But the man did not know that yet. He had to decide, do I believe him? Or do I not? And he believed him, and the man was changed. And the passage says, when the family found out that this was Jesus who did this, they believed as well. The family changed. So, faith is believing what we cannot see, but faith's reward is actually seeing what we have believed. Faith's reward is actually seeing what we have believed. We believe, and then we see. And that's what Jesus is telling his disciples in John chapter 14. Trust in God, trust also in me. I'm going to tell you. Let me tell you what I'm going to do. And the question is, are you going to trust that? Are you going to believe that? Are you going to put your confidence in that? That would be real faith. Now, it's very important you understand when we say real faith, we're not talking about blind faith in the sense that there's no credibility behind it. In other words, having faith in an object that is unworthy of faith doesn't make sense at all, okay? So for me to have confidence that my car can get me to the moon is kind of dumb, right? There's no evidence, there's no evidentiary proof that my car would ever be capable of getting me to the moon. You'd say, you can have all kinds of faith, but if you put them in the wrong object, your faith is going to be frustrated. And I would say again, the scripture makes it very clear that our faith is not a blind faith. We've got the evidence of history. We've got the evidence of fulfilled prophecy. We've got the evidence of Jesus Christ's work on earth. We've got the evidence of the resurrection. We've got the evidence of his church. We've got the evidence of transformed lives. I mean, there's all kinds of evidence to say it's reasonable to trust in Jesus, but there are things he's asking us to trust in that we don't have evidence for. So we've got a reliable source, and we can take that reliable source and trust him for greater things. And so the second question we have to ask and answer is, does your faith rest in a worthy object? I mean, is it really a faith that's in a worthy object? So first of all, do you have superficial faith or do you have real faith? And secondly, what are you trusting in? What are you trusting in? Is it a worthy object? And let me just say this. For all of you here who are kind of skeptical, you kind of say, you know, I don't really know. Why would I do this? Let me just encourage you to look at Jesus, to look at who he is and what he said, because I think you're going to find in him, I can commend him to you, he is a worthy object. I have spent the better part of my life personally on a journey to understand this. For me to stand up and talk in front of you guys in order to get a paycheck, some people might do that, but that's not me. I mean, there are other ways I could earn a living than standing up and talking about something I don't believe in. The reason why I believe in it is because I spent my life studying it, and I'm not saying just trust me. I'm saying follow that example. If you guys would do the same, I believe if you would sincerely investigate, you're going to find credible evidence for Jesus Christ. Well, let's go back to John chapter 14, and let's look at what Jesus is asking us to believe in. What's he asking us to believe in? Well, the first thing he's asking us to believe in is that Jesus Christ himself personally is the placemaker. Jesus Christ personally is the placemaker. Look what he says in verse 2. He says, "In my Father's house are many rooms. If it were not so, I would have told you. I am going there, that is to my Father's house, to prepare a place for you. And if I go and prepare a place for you, I will come back and take you to be with me, that you also may be where I am." What Jesus is saying to his disciples is, listen, I want you to trust me, believe me, when I leave this world, after I die, and after I'm resurrected, I'm going to leave you guys. I'm going to go back to my Father. And when I get there, I am going into my Father's big house that has many rooms, and I'm preparing a place for you. And we'll talk a little bit about what that means in just a minute, but don't so much think about yourself seeing Jesus with a carpenter's belt on, you know, with his tools in there, and, you know, he's working away to put the trim on your place. Okay, he's trying to get the right granite based on your favorite color. That's not what we're talking about. What we're talking about is Jesus is creating the kingdom. He's in the process of putting heaven together. He's putting his plan for the consummation of the ages together. He's making all that work out. And what that's going to work out with for you is that you're going to be part of a family whose Father is none other than God himself, who lives together in harmony. Now, I know some of you guys have in your mind that heaven is going to be like a big subdivision, you know, with streets of gold, and, you know, you're going to get your mansion there, and so you're going to get to live by yourself. And for you who are introverts, you think, well, isn't it going to be blissful? You know, I can go in, I can hit the garage door closer and shut the door behind myself, and I'll just be by myself forever. And that will be wonderful. No one to bug me. That's not the picture here. The picture here is like one gigantic house. Now, here's the miracle. The miracle, introverts, is not that you get to be alone for all of eternity. The miracle is that those extroverts will not bug you. Now, I don't know if God's going to turn them down or tune you up or whether that's just, I mean, what we're talking about is God bringing his sons and daughters to a place where we will live together and enjoy perfect harmony with him forever and ever. And as we sang about earlier, we will be faultless in that place, living with the perfect creativity and the perfect empathy and the perfect understanding to take all that God created in the potential of the human mind and heart for each individual here and then melding those all together in this grand family called the family of God. Talk about utopia. No one has ever dreamed or conceived all of these things. And Jesus is saying, listen, I'm going to make all that. I'm doing all the preparations for that. And I'm going to come and get you. And I'm going to take you there to be with me in that setting. Now they're thinking, Jesus, how can you leave us? And Jesus is saying, don't worry, I'm going to come get you. And you're going to be with me in my Father's house with all of the people that have been redeemed forever and ever. Jesus is the placemaker. Then he says this really bizarre statement. He says, you know the way to the place where I'm going. You know the way to the place where I'm going. And I love this next verse. Thomas said to him, Thomas is my favorite disciple today. I love this. He says, Lord, we don't know where you're going, so how can we know the way? I mean, anytime you got somebody that's got the courage in the room to ask what everybody else is thinking, but everybody else is afraid to ask, you know, and Thomas is willing to just kind of get out there and ask. I love that about this guy. If you're a person who feels like you've got lots and lots of questions about the Bible and about God and about life and about faith and about morality and about ethics and all those kinds of things, but you feel like you better not say something in your small group or you better not say something in your Sunday school class or don't say something to one of the pastors on staff because you're going to get chastised. Why are you asking that question? That is so far from right. I mean, we want those questions. We explore faith together. And look at what Jesus says. Thomas, you idiot. That's not what he says, is it? Jesus answers his question. I used to have a professor in seminary, and every once in a while somebody would have read a book. And they would raise their hand, and they would go on a tear, and they'd say, oh, you know, I read so-and-so, and so-and-so says, and so-and-so says, and so-and-so says, and the rest of us are kind of going, oh, no, we want to hear the professor, not you. But anyway, he would go on, the person would go on, and oftentimes this professor would just cut people off in class and say, you know, that's really a stupid question. I'm not even going to dignify it with an answer. You say, at a seminary? Yeah, yeah. So maybe that's where you get the impression that religious people don't answer questions. So Jesus answers the question, and he answers it with a statement that has resonated through history. Jesus says, I am the way and the truth and the life. Definite article in front of all three of those descriptions. This is an emphatic statement. I am the way. I am the truth. I am the life. And then he clarifies it in case we don't understand the exclusivity of what he just said. He says, no one comes to the Father except through me. Whoa. In other words, to have access to the kingdom, to be invited into heaven, to be brought into heaven, you come through Jesus. What Jesus is saying here is I am not only the placemaker, but I am actually the waymaker. I am the one who gets you there. Now, when you hear that statement of Jesus, disassociate that from anything you might have heard in religion or in church so that you can allow yourself to really interact with what he's saying here. because so much of us, at the time, we are loaded down with baggage of church being involved in power-seeking, political struggles, crusades, trying to power up with their agenda on people for their moral values and all that kind of stuff. And so we've kind of gotten to this point that Christianity is kind of intolerant, or Christianity is kind of narrow in a really negative way. Just take a moment, just try to kind of push that aside, what humans have done with the statement, and let's just talk about what Jesus meant by the statement in the fullest understanding of what he's saying here. When Jesus says, "I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me," there are a couple things here that we have to take a look at. The first one is the issue of sincerity. Sincerity. Some people would say, well, you know, it seems like that if people are sincere, there would be other paths. That people who are truly wanting to come to God could find a different path than this path. Or people in other parts of the world that don't have access to the Bible, that they would be sincerely seeking God, they would find another way. And the first thing I would simply say is that Jesus says in this passage, no one comes to the Father except through me. In other words, what Jesus is saying is those paths don't exist. There's one path, and that's through him. So let's just talk about sincerity for just a moment. Would everybody in here agree that sincerity in and of itself could be a very negative thing? In other words, sincerity is not always positive, because what happens when you're sincerely wrong? Would you say that people who have the fearless courage to strap a bomb-loaded vest to their body and walk into a room full of innocent people and blow them up because they think that that will somehow advance the cause of oppressed people, do you think that they're sincere about doing that? I think we would say that some of those people are some of the most sincere people in the world. They so believe in that, they will sacrifice their life and do something that's outrageous. So sincerity as a quality in and of itself doesn't commend whether you're right or whether you're wrong. It really doesn't. So let's move to the question of narrowness. Is narrowness in and of itself a terrible thing? I would suggest to you that we live in a world where we use narrowness every day, and we use it in a positive way. So, for example, if I went to the doctor and I said, I've got a bronchial infection, right, and I need something really strong. And the doctor said, well, yeah, I've got some antibiotics for you to take here. No, I don't want antibiotics. I want something really strong. Can I get some of those chemotherapy drugs? You say, well, those chemotherapy drugs are not going to fix your bronchitis. They're not. That's not what they're for. Well, that's really narrow. I just can't believe it. I can't believe you're narrow. Are you saying that there's not multiple kinds of drugs for this and I could just kind of pick the one I want? Now, we understand narrow. Like, how many people can email you using whatever random email address they want to? You say, well, they can't. When it comes time to cross the river, you go on a narrow bridge, right? Because that's how you get across. We live in a world where we understand what things are narrow. And what works and what doesn't work. So just because Jesus says, I am the one way, doesn't in and of itself make it wrong. So then you have to ask and answer the question, and I'm going to give you a really brief answer of a really perplexing question. What about people around the world that don't have the Bible? Our global outreach pastor helped me understand this. He says, Tim, if we have faith to believe that Jesus Christ died for the sins of the world, if there's somebody someplace in the world that is sincerely and truly seeking God, do we not believe that God could not get the message of Jesus Christ to them? Do we not believe that? God is truly capable of doing that. And what we're seeing right now throughout the Muslim world are lots and lots and lots of people are coming to Christ through visions of Jesus that they're seeing in dreams. To the point where some of the Muslim apologists or the Muslim clerics are telling their people, hey, when you see that guy in the white robe in your dream, ignore him. Isn't that interesting? Because it's becoming so common that Jesus is revealing himself to people in myriads of ways around the world. God is capable of doing that. So don't let the narrowness of this cause you to back away from it. Let the narrowness of this cause you to focus on what Jesus is saying here. And let's look carefully at what Jesus is saying here. Jesus is saying, I am the way. He's not saying, I lead the way. He's not saying, I can point you to the way. Jesus is saying, I actually am the way. I am the way. I'm going to do something to fix the broken path. You see, the way to God has been broken by our own human sin and guilt. The path has been broken. There's no way we can bridge the chasm to get there. And Jesus is saying, I will be the one who does what it takes to fix the problem of sin so that we can actually come to God. In fact, in 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 18, I'll put it up here so you can see it. Peter writes this, he says, Christ died for sins once for all, the righteous, Jesus, for the unrighteous, to bring you to God. He's the one that actually brings us there. He is the way. He is the way, okay? When Jesus says, I am the truth, what Jesus is talking about is that which corresponds to reality. What Jesus is saying is, I am the truth. What I am is the revelation of how God's plan is unfolding in the world. So listen to what I'm telling you. There are lots of other people out there that will tell you other truths, but I'm the one that gets you there. And then finally, I am the life. Jesus Christ is the one who can raise the dead. And we're going to see this. We saw it in Lazarus. We're going to see it in Jesus. Now, every single one of us benefits from a waymaker. I remember one of those incredible times. It was actually the first time I traveled in Central Asia. We had a flight into Tashkent, Uzbekistan, and landed in Tashkent, the city of about 4 million people, Russian and Uzbek and a number of other groups there, and everything's in Cyrillic. It's the Russian alphabet, so I can't read any road signs. I can't read any street signs, and there was a group of us. We went to the subway to go from one place to another, and as we crowded into the subway, this place was just packed with people, just all kinds of people, and we had a group of nine, and so we were trying to hang together to get in, and I remember the subway doors opened up, and our guy immediately pushed their way in, and I'm thinking, you know, being the polite American, okay, you can go, like personal space, you know, and all that stuff. And suddenly, I realized, like, I'm going to be left here on the platform by myself with nowhere to go and not a way to communicate with anybody. So I started pushing. I pushed my way in, and I got in. I could feel the door starting to close behind me. I looked over my shoulder, and there was our family pastor, who is now the pastor of our Pflugerville church, Danny Box, standing on the outside. Danny takes three steps back, lowers his shoulder, and just plows into that door. I mean, all the little babushkas, they just, like, you could see them just kind of ricocheting off of one another as he came through that door. Now, a lot of you guys don't know Danny. So let me give you a picture of him so you can see what he looks like. They're at the Crazy Gals Cafe. He's not a small man. And so he got in there, and, you know, I was feeling a little bit bad for what had just happened until we got to the first stop, and then all those babushkas almost pushed me down, shoving to get out the door. So anyway, 2 weeks later, after our trip, we fly back to Moscow, and we're in Moscow, and a big, huge city, and we've got a guide, and our guide takes us down, and we go through Red Square, but we wanted to see the armory where all the jewels were, and the guide needed to get back, so she left, and we said, hey, we got this. We can find our way home. We'll be good. We've learned a couple letters. We can do this. So we toured the armory, and then we came into the subway right during rush hour traffic, and we looked and looked and looked to find our line, and we found the place where we were supposed to go downstairs to go to the line we were supposed to ride out to the suburbs. And as we got to that place, there were four escalators bringing people up toward us from way down in the bowels of the subway, and there was nothing going down. And so I'm thinking to myself, if Danny took 10 steps back and went running into that traffic going down, and I followed right behind him, you know, good fullback, maybe we could get to the bottom. And I turn, and there's a guy standing there. He's looking at the whole thing himself, and I said to him, do you speak English? And he said, oh, well, of course I speak English. And he said, you can't get on your subway line, right? And I said, nope. He said, follow me. So we take off, and we're going with him. And Danny's saying to me, who is this guy? I don't know. Like, where's he taking us? I don't know. He said he'd get us to our subway line. And sure enough, he took us around a couple corridors to a place where the subway escalator actually went down. We got on the subway. We're riding along with him. I find out that he's a diplomat from the Caucasus and that he works there in Moscow. And we talked to him for a while. And finally, we get to a place and he says, okay, this is your stop. Get off here. So we get off. We walk upstairs. And there we're standing in the little area right where we left, exactly where we were supposed to be. He was our waymaker. That's what Jesus is saying to you. If you will trust in me, I will get you into the Father's house. I'm the one who can do this. Now, when Jesus said, I am the way, to his disciples, it was literally hours from that point that he would be traveling down the way to the cross, the Via Dolorosa, with a big, huge wooden cross beam tied to his back. When Jesus said to them, I am the truth, it would be just a matter of a few hours before he was standing in a kangaroo court while liars were getting up accusing him of things he never said and he never did, and he would be convicted by liars. When Jesus said to them, I am the life, it will literally be just a few hours before his body lay cold and lifeless, a corpse in the grave. If his disciples simply took this statement and said, I will believe it if I can see it, all the evidence that Jesus is the way, the truth, and the life would have pointed to opposite, everything opposite of what he said. If their faith was superficial, if it was only based on what they could see, then they would have rejected and walked away. But they trusted in Jesus Christ. And a few days later, their faith was rewarded when Jesus, the way, the truth, and the life, came from the grave and then ascended into heaven. And these men spent the rest of their lives in poverty and persecution preaching this incredible story. And Jesus says to us, because they saw, they believed, but blessed are you who have not seen and still believe. I am the way and the truth and the life. Do you believe this? Let's bow our heads for prayer.